Welcome back to Open Line. Bob Singleton in for Fred Anderley on WOSU 820. This hour, we'll explore the inner workings of an American hospital and the financial, medical, ethical, cultural challenges of a healthcare system under pressure. Our guest, Julie Solomon, has written for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the New Yorker, Vanity Fair, other publications. She's the author of 7 books. Her latest, the one we're discussing this hour, is Hospital: Man, Woman, Birth, Death, Infinity, Plus Red Tape, Bad Behavior, Money, God, and Diversity on Steroids. Wow. Welcome to Open Line, Julie Solomon.
Hi, how are you?
Julie, the book, on the cover, it calls itself Warts and All: Exploration of the Struggles Suffered and the Triumphs Achieved by America's Healthcare Professionals, as experienced in one hospital over a year's time. Now, I'm afraid this is going to have me in trouble for the entire hour, and I had to laugh when I read this. The hospital, Maimonides.
That's it. Okay. Maimonides
Medical Center in Brooklyn. Here's the great line. At Maimonides, nothing was simple. Half the staff could not even pronounce the hospital's name. Why in the world? Well, there's a long story behind how the hospital got its name, but it does seem odd that there would be a name that was so unusual, so difficult to explore, to pronounce, that it would be worth mentioning in your story, in your book, that half the staff can't do it.
I know. It's so funny. Well, I think part of it is it's actually a little bit the story of the hospital itself, and that's why I just called the book Hospital, because I think Maimonides is not so different from a lot of hospitals. It was founded 100 years ago to take care of, it was a community hospital taking care of a largely immigrant Jewish community. Well, now 100 years later, it's a huge hospital, 700 beds, and the community now includes people from all over the world. It's in Brooklyn, New York, so it's diversity on steroids, 67 languages spoken there. And I chose the hospital chose me, one or the other, partly because in some respects it's unusual, and in many respects the problems there are the problems that I think almost every major hospital in the country faces today.
The title, Man, Woman, Birth, Death, Infinity, that struck a bell with me. I'm Dr. Ben Casey's demographic, I guess. It was the opening to, in 1950s, was it? Maybe early 60s, TV show starring Vince Edwards, a surly physician. Always sort of, he was great at curling his lip, and I don't know about his bedside manner.
But, well, you know, when she's just 18, I'd get up in the middle of the night every night to feed her, and I'd put on the television set. And Ben Casey reruns were on every night. So I think I must have seen in the winter of 1989 and 1990 every Ben Casey episode that was ever made.
Ben Casey is probably responsible, or was at any rate, for a lot of people going into medicine, because it was a good character and good program, seemed that way to me anyway. But what is it doing in the title of your book?
Because I think Ben Casey and Dr. Kildare and even ER and Grey's Anatomy, today's version of those shows, or even Scrubs for that matter, I think they show you a kind of idealistic side of the medical world. You know, it's always people at the moment of, you know, moment of revelation, moment of romance, moment of, you know, these incredible conversations between doctors and patients and doctors and each other. And I think that is what doctors hope for and nurses when they go into the profession. And unfortunately, what they often find when they get into the real world of the hospital is what comes next, which is red tape, bad behavior, money, God, and diversity on steroids. And certainly, at least in most hospitals, the red tape, bad behavior, and money issues have become huge.
To stay with the TV side for a moment, you write, all these programs have brought the operating room home. You can watch liposuction performed. You can watch babies delivered, all without leaving your couch. You can read all about your symptoms and their treatment on the Internet. All of this, you write, is opening once shrouded information reserved for a highly educated elite to anyone who can plug in a computer. That's certainly true. A lot of that witch doctor mumbo jumbo is not so exotic anymore because we know so much of it. We run into it as a matter of routine. What's this doing to the doctor-patient relationship or the patient-hospital relationship?
I think it's making it really difficult. You know, one of the things that I found in spending the year at the hospital, and I tell the story of the hospital through the stories of the people working there, and I think one of the, you know, before it was probably too much in one direction in that maybe there was too much deference paid to the medical people by the patient. And I think now it's probably swung too much in the other direction where nobody trusts anybody. And I think that people are yearning to have a relationship with a medical person who they trust just to help them sort out all the information that's out there.
You talk about expectations people have because of this knowledge and how it compares to the reality. Too often death is conquered on TV, but it's still out there in the halls of your hospital.
Well, that's right. And I think one of the things that I really saw over and over again, one of the groups of doctors I was following especially closely were oncologists who are cancer doctors. And, you know, cancer has become, in many cases of cancer, it's become a much more curable or chronic disease than it was 20 or 30 years ago. But many kinds of cancer still do not have a real cure for most people. And I think, you know, every day on the front page of the newspaper, you'll hear some great new cure, you know, heralded by the newspapers. And then, of course, 3 or 4 weeks later, there'll be a small correction in the back of the newspaper saying, well, maybe those drug trials weren't as conclusive as we thought. And I think what happens is that I don't think our medical professionals are, you know, it's looked at as a defeat if a patient isn't cured. And I think our whole society has to look at the cycle of life and death a little bit more realistically.
Your hospital, you touched on this a moment ago. The hospital's kosher kitchen was run by Patrick Lamont, born in Jamaica. And 67 different languages, more or less, were spoken in this hospital. It led to a number of cultural quirks. White blankets in the ER kept Chinese away because to them, white is the mark of death. So Maimonides' hospital switched to beige-colored blankets. In the pediatric ER, Pakistani babies arrive between 3 and 5 a.m., and you figure that's because that's when cab drivers change their shifts, and there's so many Pakistani cab drivers in Brooklyn, I guess. There must be a string. Well, there is a string that goes on and on and on of these things, but it must make for a fascinating environment.
It is fascinating, and I think what was most fascinating to me was how people managed to deal with those cultural differences. I mean, in a way, one of the most heartening parts of being in that hospital for a year was to see that here you have all these different people who, if you listen to the news, should be at each other's throats because they're from not only alien cultures but warring cultures. The hospital became a demilitarized zone where everybody was there for the same thing, to try to help one another get better. And for the most part, they really did. And I guess this sort of touched a chord with me personally because I actually grew up in southern Ohio, in Seaman, Ohio, and my parents were immigrant Jews living in Adams County where there was only one or two other Jewish families. And so I grew up understanding what it was to be, I guess we were the multiculturalism, and we were always made to feel very much at home there. And so I think I felt a kind of resonance at this hospital, although obviously in a much greater proportion. One of the things that happened, one of the doctors I followed around was actually this cute young guy who was the true minority at Maimonides. He was a young white guy from Nebraska who didn't have any noticeable cultural markings on him. And his dad came to visit him in the course of the year. His father was a doctor out in Lincoln, Nebraska. And even there, he said, they now at their hospital in Lincoln, Nebraska, have to deal on a regular basis with 7 or 8 different languages because most cities now have fairly sizable immigrant populations.
7 or 8 different languages, and you've got 67.
Yeah.
We have a similar situation in the Columbus Public School System. I think, I can't remember the exact number, but it was an astonishing number, the different languages, the native languages that are spoken by students. They've come here from all over the world, but they're all doing their best to speak English to one another while they're in the schools, I guess. But
well, that's right, but they still, you know, and I think one of the things that's interesting, you know, our country went through this 100 years ago. There was a huge wave of immigration, and then for many, many years, it was sort of not such a big wave of immigration, and now we've gone through it again over the last 20 or 30 years. We're almost at the levels of 100 years ago, and percentage-wise, so the numbers are even bigger. And I think that the whole country is, I mean, one of the things I felt as I was writing about the hospital, that the book is, yes, about a hospital and the world inside the hospital, but it also is about the larger issues of our society that are just at a more intense pressure cooker in the hospital environment.
You're talking about diversity on steroids. You mentioned the World Trade Center attacks, the war on terror, the war in Iraq, how that's amplified everything. Muslim versus Christian and Jew, Muslim versus Hindu, modernity versus fundamentalism, consumerism versus environmentalism, us versus them, us versus us. It took just a few visits to see that Maimonides was an epicenter of these social forces, a petri dish of the post-9/11 world. Well, there you go, on steroids at least. And a very densely packed, all these people adding to the pressures that's on everyone in their relationships. The ER, you write, sees, 84,000 patients a year, not the busiest in the city or the world, but arguably the most intense. 84,000 patients in a year's time. How intense? Well, one doctor came up with a formula. He found, 6 patients per square foot per year. I don't know exactly what that means, but it seems extremely crowded to me.
Well, that's what I felt. It just sounded packed.
Yeah, almost sardine-like.
Yeah, no, it is. And yet what was also incredible, that was another example, how in that ER, and the crowded ER is a situation at almost every major hospital in the country because so many uninsured people, whether they're immigrants or not, have to use the ER as their doctor's office because they don't have insurance. And one of the things that was quite amazing to me was how they kept track of all the people. They had this very, very up-to-the-minute computer system that really monitored each patient in real time. So as soon as that patient was seen by a nurse, she would enter it into the computer and give an initial diagnosis. And so that was the good part, so that they knew what every patient was in there, how long they'd been, whether they had had an initial screening, what stage they were along in the process. The bad part was some of those patients were in that ER for 12, 15, 18 hours. And that's pretty brutal.
And some of them never leave. You talk about Mr. Zen. What's his situation? Here's an illegal alien who has no health insurance, who's gone to the hospital, and you can't. Is he a cancer patient?
He's a cancer patient, and what happened was, I mean, he's in a chapter where I describe 2 completely contradictory forces that are going on in the hospital that completely illustrate to me the irrationality of our healthcare system. On the one hand, if you've been a patient in the hospital, you know that the minute you check into the hospital, they're trying to check you out because the insurance, most insurance coverage only covers a certain number of days for whatever your diagnosis is. If you stay in one day longer, the hospital starts to lose money on you. So that on the one hand, they're trying to get the patients in and out as quickly as possible, but the hospitals can't, by law, discharge you until you're able to walk out. So that's why they're always trying to find a rehab place or someplace else to get you into the next state so you're not in the hospital anymore because your insurance isn't covered. Well, Mr. Zen came in through the emergency room with a huge sarcoma cancer, and they admitted him into the hospital, and he stayed for over a year and ran up a bill of over $1 million that was never going to get paid by anybody. So on the one hand, everybody's moving through the system very quickly. On the other hand, some patients never leave.
Everybody got to know Mr. Zen. How do you solve a problem like that? I don't know.
I know, and that's the other irony with Mr. Zen is here's this guy who was actually a very nice man. He'd lived in this country for 20 years. He was a kitchen worker. He'd always worked. But this was not a person who had very much good luck in his life, and he was in the hospital, and because he was one of the few patients who actually stayed there for a longer period of time, the doctors and the nurses on the staff at the hospital got to know him quite well. And so even though he was costing the hospital a lot of money, he was became the favorite patient. He didn't complain. He was happy to be there. It was a very bizarre situation. But not unusual. I've had doctors write letters to me from all over the country saying, yeah, this is a familiar situation.
Emblematic of the big picture, which people don't like to think about too much, the big picture. Thinking about the big picture, you write, could crush you. And the big picture is that healthcare expenses in the United States, this is from your book, healthcare expenses in the United States rose from just over $1,000 per person in 1980 to over $6,000 per person in 2004. And the overall cost has gone from $255 billion overall in 1980, $255 billion, to nearly $2 trillion in 2004. That's the big picture. And a lot of that is because of situations like Mr. Zen.
Well, it's Mr. Zen, and it's because we don't have a rational payment system. You know, the hospital said, for example, 15 years ago, they dealt with 5 insurance companies. Now they deal with 21 insurance companies, and it seems as though every one of those insurance companies are trying more and more to find fewer ways to reimburse, to give you less coverage for more money. And so it feels like there's this system has just become completely irrational.
I will mention to our listeners that you're hearing some voices in the background. Julie Solomon is speaking to us on a public telephone from, the lobby of LaGuardia International Airport?
I was flying to Columbus from Washington, D.C. this morning, supposedly at 7:20. My flight got canceled. They flew me to LaGuardia. I'm waiting here for my plane to Columbus because I'm actually going to speak tonight at at the Barnes & Noble on Olentangy River Road. And so in between, you guys were so great to reschedule this from the phone booth.
Well, we're hoping to make it through the hour. And we'll just have to see how it all works out. But I want to bring listeners into the conversation. If you'd like to get involved, we have a line for you at 292-8513, 292-8513. And let me tell you again, our guest is Julie Solomon. Her book is Hospital, Man, Woman, Birth, Death, Infinity, plus Red Tape, Bad Behavior, Money, God, and Diversity on Steroids. And as Julie just mentioned, she will be eventually in Columbus, hopefully tonight, at Barnes & Noble at the Lennox Center on Olentangy River Road. Do you know what time you're supposed to be there?
It's 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock, okay.
And my plane's supposed to arrive at 2, so I should be fine.
Good. Looking through your book, I came across a familiar name, Les Wexner.
Oh, yes.
Lex Wexner, founder of Limited Brands, headquartered right here in Columbus, is mentioned by one of the doctors who's, he was talking about health care and money. The doctor was talking about Les Wexner's business model. It works so well in the limited stores. His father ran a department store, lost money in a lot of sections of the store, but the women's sports apparel was going great. So Les Wexner thought, well, why fool around with what's losing money? Let's concentrate on what's making money. And the end result was The Limited. And he's done fairly well.
That's right. And this doctor was using that example to say that sort of what's happened in our healthcare system.
But it doesn't work quite so well in a hospital.
That's right. It's one thing to shop for sweaters, and it's another thing to go in for heart failure.
Why doesn't it work well?
Well, one of the things he said, you know, and I can actually, I found that part of the book while you were talking about it, that this doctor was saying that, he said, that's fine in a department store, but what happens in medicine is that people have applied the same reasoning to hospitals. He said, no, they're almost like department stores where some departments make money and some don't make money or lose money. Well, if you decide to take a profit and loss mentality for the whole system, you focus on the things that make money. That's why they open these special cardiac hospitals or orthopedic hospitals. If you want to maximize profits, that's good, but if you're thinking about the healthcare system, you wouldn't look at it that way because you want to have, you know, a lot of being a doctor is listening and taking history and looking at the whole person. And the problem with going to a cardiac hospital, what if you develop some other complication in some other part of your body? You don't have people there on hand who can necessarily treat it. And I think one of the issues that I saw with the way our insurance system is set up right now, It's very difficult for people to go into just general practice, to become internist, you know, to have a doctor who looks at your whole body at once. And I think we've become so over-specialized that I think a lot of people feel that they have to be the one managing their own care. And you know what? As much information as you can get on the internet, it's still a lot more complicated. And so I think that somehow that the way we look at health care, this is a pillar of the community, and I think that we as citizens should say, wait a second, there has to be a more rational way that I shouldn't have to mortgage my house to take care of my health.
Isn't there another problem along these same lines? Cardiac hospitals make money, so surprise, surprise, there are a lot of cardiac hospitals. Everybody you see suddenly has a heart trouble because that's where the money is.
That's right. And, you know, and the problem with that is, again, is that, you know, first of all, a lot of people wouldn't have heart problems if they did preventive medicine. Well, how do you do preventive medicine? You go for regular checkups. You learn good, healthy ways of living. And the way people often do that is if they have a healthcare practitioner they trust and they go to, they can learn how to take care of themselves better so they don't end up in the hospital. But the whole system is geared towards the emergency, towards the big procedure, towards the thing that's going to, you know, make cash. And that's really not the right way to go.
We are starting to get some callers. Let's go to Ben. Hello, Ben. Welcome to Open Line.
Hi, I just wanted to let the author know that I really am heartened by her description of Maimonides. Having been a pediatric resident there from 2001 to 2004, what she describes really resonates well with me. I was there during 9/11, and having grown up in Columbus, it was really a very enlightening experience to spend 3 years in Borough Park. So I just wanted to applaud her, and I... if you could repeat the name of her book, I would. I listened a little late, so
I will.
I just wanted to appreciate that.
You
just
go to hospital, Julie Salomon, Salamon. You'll be able to find it right away because I think you especially will appreciate it as somebody who was actually at the hospital.
Yeah, you were describing a definite segment of my life experience at Maimonides. Quite an amazing place to be. So thank you very much. I don't have a question.
Okay, you may have passed one another in the hallway.
Probably.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot,
Ben.
Thank you.
Let's go to Rick. Hello, Rick. Welcome to Open Line.
Yeah, I kind of tuned in.
Oh, wait. Rick, I'm sorry. I wasn't watching the clock. We have to go away for a short break. Stay with us. We'll come. We'll be right back in about a minute and a half on WOSU 820 NPR News.
next time on Day to Day.
Being close to someone is nice.
But does it have its limits?
I'm standing there like a pervert outside the women's bathroom hoping nobody comes by.
Try staying within 15 feet of your sweet baboo for 24 hours.
You know, I'm going to sound really mean here.
I was making a willful effort, and I don't think you were, sweetie.
Putting togetherness to the test.
Mwah. Next time on Day to Day.
That story will be coming up when Day to Day is here at noon, just about 30 minutes away. Day to Day on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. It is 83 degrees at 11:31. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. WOSU joins the Columbus Arts Festival tomorrow through Sunday in the Discovery District. This premier Welcome to Summer Festival showcases works by fine artists and craftspeople. It includes art activities, live music, and great food from Columbus restaurants. To get more information about visiting us at the WOSU booth at the Columbus Arts Festival, just go to gcac.org. Get perspective on all the day's news with All Things Considered and the latest business news on Marketplace. Weekdays at 4. Now on WOSU 89.7 FM. And in the weather forecast, partly sunny skies today, a slight chance of showers, and a high of 89. Mostly clear tonight and muggy, a low of 68.
Welcome back to Open Line. Bob Singleton in for Fred Anderle on WOSU 820. We're talking about health care, specifically one hospital where our guest spent a year just studying everything that moved and most things that didn't. Our guest is Julie Solomon. Her book is Hospital, Man, Woman, Birth, Death, Infinity, plus Red Tape, Bad Behavior, Money, God, and Diversity on Steroids. It's all about Maimonides Hospital in Brooklyn, New York. And before I interrupted with all of this, we were talking to Rick. Are you still with us, Rick?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead with your question. Thank you.
Well, I kind of tuned into you just here for the last couple minutes, so bear with me. I may be repeating a question that was asked earlier. From all of the author's studies here, what is driving this increase? I mean, to me, I'm a bottom lines guy. I'm a business guy. I've been in the business for years. But, you know, I hear politically charged accusations back and forth from both sides. Some people say it's the insurance companies. Some people say it's greed. I believe in a capitalist system as long as it's tempered with a certain amount of morality to it. But what does the author see as the bottom line here? What's causing this if there is one or multiple problems?
I think the bottom line is a little bit of both. I think what has happened, not just in the hospital business, but in business generally, is that there's been just sort of at the top of the heap sort of outsized dollars. And I think that the way the insurance reimbursement has sort of shifted over the last 15 years has been to pay really extraordinary reimbursement for certain kinds of procedures and then minimal reimbursement for others. And it's partly a result of so much subspecialization over the last 20 years. And managed care also fed into it, because now once you go to your primary care doctor, you're referred then to go to this specialist or that specialist. And if you look at the reimbursement structure, for example, at the hospital, they started 5 years ago having a nurse whose whole job now is to be a documentation specialist. And it's basically to try, she walks around with this thick code. And basically, if the doctors code one procedure one way and they code it another way, and the difference can be just a slight difference in description, it can be a difference in thousands of dollars of reimbursement. So it's almost as though there's nobody overseeing the amount of money that can be charged for these procedures. And it's a tricky business, because you're right, we have a free market system, so you don't want to have tons of government regulation. But on the other hand, this is sort of private enterprise gone amok, and it's in an area of health which feels a little different than other kinds of business.
Well, I know, having been through the healthcare system, my wife a few years ago was gravely ill, and I know the tab for that, fortunately, insurance covered almost all of it. It was over $300,000. And it was a life and death struggle for about 6 months. But the system worked for her, but it was very expensive to do. And the doctor said that it was short of a miracle that she survived the illness.
And you were lucky, thank heavens, that you had insurance that covered it. Because what's happened now is one of the things I was saying earlier, that now there are so many different insurance carriers, and they unfortunately cover less and less and less. And so people do end up in situations where their illnesses are not being covered.
Well, thank you. You've answered some of my questions, and I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Speaking of money, let's talk a little bit about the Cancer Center, a $50 million investment by Maimonides Hospital. They're in competition with other hospitals across the river in Manhattan. And there is a problem because only 26% of the hospital's Brooklyn service area, the borough, actually go to Maimonides for their cancer treatment. They do go across the river. And worse, you point out, those patients with insurance tend to favor Manhattan. Those without insurance and with little money go to Maimonides. So here's a hospital that's invested a big chunk of change in this cancer center, having trouble paying for it because the patients with money are going somewhere else.
Well, that's it, and that brings up another aspect of hospital life, which really I found surprising, but apparently is quite common. One of the things that was hurting business in the initial startup of the cancer center was there was this long-time feud going on between two of the prominent doctors, and one of them had a huge oncology practice, and he would not send his patients to the new cancer center. And it was really hurting their business, and it was also probably hurting that doctor. He was a good doctor, but because he had a feud with a doctor associated with the hospital, he kept his patients away. I thought, wow, that must just be Brooklyn. And then again, I've been getting emails from doctors in Denver and all over the country saying, oh, yeah, we've got one of those at our hospital, too.
So you've got patients who may die because they can't get the treatment they need or the hospital can't afford to provide it, not because of some rational roadblock, but because two doctors are mad at each other and they can't reach a compromise and get things going.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, probably the patients may not die necessarily. They may get care elsewhere, but it will certainly be less convenient care. Instead of driving 5 minutes from their house, they may have to drive 45 minutes or an hour, and when you're sick, that's a lot of time.
You write, it wasn't unusual for people to cross the bridge, go to Manhattan for radiation treatments and chemotherapy, but then they would end up back in Brooklyn at Maimonides' emergency room when it came time to die.
Yeah, that's right.
So all of the money for the treatment goes to Manhattan, and all the expense of caring for this dying individual goes on Maimonides.
That's right. And, you know, and yet to not, you know, I mean, I think that what I tried to do in the book was to show all of the different layers going on, because obviously many, many patients are treated there. They do get good treatment, but the hospital is struggling between its desire, I think a genuine desire, to be a community hospital, serve everybody in the community, the people who can pay and the people who can't. But in order to provide those services, they need enough of the patients with good insurance to pay for it. And so it's this incredible balancing act that I found absolutely fascinating.
You think it would be helpful if our politicians spent a year in a hospital the way you did?
Yes, I was just saying to somebody, last night. In fact, I would love for the various candidates to read my book, just because I do think it would be very illuminating for them, because I think No. I think I come from a family of physicians. My father was a doctor. My sister's a doctor at a big hospital up in Boston. I thought I was pretty familiar. You know, I've got two kids, so I've been in and out of emergency rooms plenty. But I tell you, until you are there day in and day out, you have no idea what the complexity of the institution is. There is just so much going on that I do, you know, and it's funny, politicians would come in and out of the hospital all of the time. You know, they'd make the little photo op stop at the emergency room and make some pronouncement, and then they'd leave. But they, I truly think very few people have an idea of what's really going on inside.
I wanted to go back to something that was mentioned earlier, and that's the diversity on steroids. People from everywhere, all coming together in this hospital. But this is a hospital that's been around for a century or more, and it was initially built to serve the Jewish community in this particular borough, Brooklyn. Suddenly there's 9/11, and there are a lot of Muslims in the area, and they are being looked at in new ways because of this attack on the Twin Towers. They can't – suddenly life is difficult for them, and they're not getting a lot of help from many directions. But the one place they do get help is from this – hospital, Maimonides Hospital, that has this has its origins in the Jewish community. So you've got the Muslims and the Jews coming together, at least in this little corner of the world. And I thought that was worth mentioning.
Yeah, no, it was true, and I have to say one of the most moving moments I had was, you know, the hospital does a lot of outreach to the various communities. When I was there, they were having a big effort to get people to come in for colon cancer screenings. They were doing free colonoscopies for anybody who would come into the hospital to do it, and the president of the hospital was going around with the head of the volunteer department, who's this very interesting guy, Douglas Jablon. He's like a 6'2" Orthodox Jew who always wears black suits. It looks like he's going to a funeral. And he has made it his personal mission to bring in the patients from the Chinese community, the Muslim community, the Haitian community. And I went with Pam Breyer, the head of the hospital, who's this tiny little woman. And we went to the biggest mosque in Brooklyn, which has 2,000 or 3,000 people. And we went through this whole giant hall filled with men praying on prayer rugs. And she was introduced by the local imam, and it was very moving. She just spoke to the people. There had just been a big earthquake in Pakistan, where most of these people were from, and she talked about her sympathy for them and how she related to them. And then she encouraged them all to come in for colonoscopies.
But she didn't tell them about that gallon of liquid that you've got to drink before you go through that procedure, that awful stuff, and what happens when you finally finish it.
It's true. It's a hard sell.
But that's another story for another show. Something I want to touch on. Where was it? This is the nuts and bolts of hospital work. Where are we? There's a report, To Err Is Human. I forget who did it in 1999.
The National Institute of Health,
okay. NIH, estimated that 98,000 people die each year in the United States because of preventable medical errors. And you mentioned that Maimonides had one of those a few years back. Someone went in to have a kidney removed, and the doctors pulled the wrong kidney.
That's right.
Always an embarrassing thing. An embarrassing development. But that was a few years back. They're not doing that a lot these days, are they?
No, and I do want to say that one thing people should feel some reassurance about, one thing I did see within the hospital, that there are all kinds of regulatory oversight bodies that come in and do inspections, and the hospitals do have constant programs to try and improve themselves. And so one thing was that preventable infections, one of the things that was causing many of those deaths was the fact that people working in the hospitals, including doctors, were not washing their hands, which is kind of shocking to me. But they put in this whole program with charts and graphs and measurements and reminders, and everybody wears buttons now that says, ask me if I wash my hands. And they have improved hand washing. It was down as low as 60% of the employees, including doctors, not washing their hands 7 years ago. But when I was there, it was up to 80%, and now they're up to the low 90s. So I think what's happened in the crush of business is sometimes common sense has kind of gone out the window, too.
Even there, even with the, all this improvement, still one out of every 10 has not washed their hands. So you got still got a pretty good chance, at least too high a chance than you should, to develop some sort of infection because a doctor or a nurse or someone else didn't wash their hands. Here's what you say about that, how depressing it is to think that you have to have a management team and charts and graphs to get medical people to wash their hands in a hospital. Something else that you talk about, this air to air is human. For various reasons, they now have what they call the team concept, where you've got a lot of different people seeing the same patient. And each time a new person comes in the room, they have to write something in the chart. And even though Maimonides Hospital is one of those that's into computers for doing at least some of this, most of these notations in the records are still done by hand, and doctors' handwriting is notoriously bad. And we've just lost our guest.
Oh no!
Oh, you're still with us? Okay,
I'm here.
What about this? Why aren't they using computers more, so that everyone can read what's written instead of making mistakes because they've read something that isn't there or made that sort of mistake?
Well, that was really one of the most shocking things. Also, was to see how little computerization there was. You know that hospitals across the country is probably one of the least computerized industries that exist. Hello?
Yes, we're still together.
You know, they're trying in many states. In Massachusetts, they've sort of mandated that everybody be on a uniform computer system, but it's really difficult because, you know, the computer systems don't talk to each other. It's very expensive, so even if the hospitals put it in, individual doctors don't want to put it in. And so I think when... Not that it will solve every problem in the world, but I think it will definitely help clarify a lot of confusion that exists around individual patient care.
You're right. Even at a computer-savvy place like Maimonides, one of the 100 most wired hospitals, electronic records were still used primarily to relay lab results and place orders for medication. Patient progress was still scribbled into charts. Well, let's see. We got a caller. I want to go to Joe. Hello, Joe. Welcome to Open Line. Joe, are you with us?
Hello?
Yes. Joe, are you with us? We've lost Joe. Julie, let me just mention to our listeners, your book again is Hospital, Man, Woman, Birth, Death, Infinity, Plus Red Tape, Bad Behavior, Money, God, and Diversity on Steroids. Julie Solomon is the author, and she will be in Columbus at 7 o'clock this evening signing copies of her book at the Barnes & Noble in the Lenox Center on Old and Tangi River Road. Well, you spent a year there researching this book. How would you feel about going back to Maimonides Hospital as a patient?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, I would feel fine about it. I think that overall, as this young man who phoned in earlier, that with all of the kind of chaos, I think it's a well-managed hospital. And I think I would say that anybody going into any hospital anywhere should do a couple of things. One, if you can, have somebody come along with you who's a family member or a friend who can sort of act as your advocate. And also, if you take any kind of medications whatsoever and you have any kind of medical condition, I would, if I can do one favor for you right now, you should type it up on a piece of paper right now and have it, you know, on a magnet on your refrigerator or someplace, because things happen to people no matter how healthy you are. And the main important thing that people need to get good treatment in the hospital is to have a good history taken. So the more information you can give, especially doctors and nurses who haven't treated you before, the better off you are. And that's at my monitors or any hospital.
Good advice. Good advice. Let's see. I think Joe may be back. Joe, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you.
Hello.
Hello. This is Joe.
Go ahead.
Well, you were talking about the colonoscopies. It's a little late to talk about that, I suppose, but I just had a colonoscopy and that was yesterday, and I did the prep, and they have a new fluid that they give you that is far less of a problem. 5 years ago, I was deathly ill with it, and now it's not bad at all. And also, one thing you could do is to keep yourself hydrated while you're taking that. And then the other thing is I found that Gatorade do the good work on that.
Gatorade?
Yes.
But does Gatorade do what the liquid is supposed to do as you're preparing?
No. No, in addition to liquid, you need to keep yourself hydrated.
We're starting, I think, I'm afraid, Joe, you must be in an automobile or something. We've lost
you. No. Yeah. Did you have me now?
Oh, no, it's Joe that we lost.
Sorry.
But, okay. Okay, anyway, you're back. I would follow the directions of the doctor when it comes to whatever you're going to be drinking. Aren't you supposed to just do nothing but the liquid?
It's clear liquid. Gatorade is one of those clear liquids that our doctor said I could take, and I had no problems at all with it.
Okay, great. I didn't mean to say anything that would discourage people from getting a colonoscopy, because it can save your life. But good luck to you if you're doing it tonight. Julie, we touched on insurance companies, how they have there used to be just five or six. Now there's 21 or more, and how that's complicated things and made for cost increases. What can you tell us about drug companies and their dealings with the hospital and how...
Well, that's another complicated issue. I mean, on the one hand, you know, everybody will tell you that the drug companies obviously do a lot of research. They provide a lot of information to doctors that they need. But then again, they also provide information that favors the drugs they sell. And one of the things that happened at the hospital is drug reps show up all the time trying to sell... You know, you could always tell who the drug rep... Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, you could always tell who the drug representatives were, because they would always have really nice suits on, and they would come in and try to encourage the doctors to do it. And one thing they did at the cancer center while I was there was they stopped letting the drug reps just kind of run through the hallways, because they felt they were influencing too much. On the other hand, the social worker at the hospital was able to corral the drug reps and sometimes get free drugs for patients who couldn't afford them. So everything at the hospital, for every good thing, there's an offsetting bad thing, and vice versa.
What was your biggest surprise?
My biggest surprise, I think, was the amount of politics that went on, and both internal and external. You know, if you're dealing with a hospital in a community, there's a lot of external politicking that has to go on, and that was quite interesting to me, just in the management of the hospital. And I think just the sort of the kind of intensity of the pressures and how it manifested itself among the people working there, that was a surprise. You know, and how hard it was to keep the floors clean. It didn't seem like that should be such a big deal, but apparently it is.
Bed management, maybe? There was some computer system that was, you mentioned that earlier, some new computer system that came in to try and increase efficiency, lots of blinking colored lights and buttons that had to be pushed. But in one instance, at least, all of the responsibility for this machine kept getting passed on to lower and lower ranking employees. And in the end, I guess the person that had the most responsibility was the lowest paid person on the floor, a health aide. How does that work, the hierarchy?
Really, Well, the hierarchy is a huge issue, and the issue of respect is a huge issue. I mean, earlier we talked about respect between patients and doctors and nurses, but the respect issue is huge in a hospital because there are very few businesses where you'll have a surgeon who can be making $1 million or more working elbow to elbow with a technician who may be earning less than $30,000 a year, and yet both of them have to be doing their jobs at top-notch level to make the operation a success. And so I think that, you know, one of the things this hospital was working on is the surgeon should actually be extra respectful to that technician because the technician's not really getting very much money out of their job. And in fact, that isn't how it works, that there is still this sort of attitude on a part of the people at the top that they're better, they're more educated. And one of the things that the administration at this hospital was trying to do was to say, you know what, this is a team. We're all in this together, and we have to help each other out because there is a tremendous hierarchy, and unlike other businesses, they actually work at doing the same thing.
We had a show earlier in the week that dealt with nursing homes and health aides, the employees that have the most intimate contact with the residents, the people that get you out of your bed and into your wheelchair and give you a bath and clean up when things get dirty. How is it in the hospital, these aides? I mean, nurses are always overworked. There's never enough nurses because it's too expensive to have the number of nurses you need. You wind up with the number of nurses that management will pay for. They're desperately in need of help, and they get it from these aides. Where are we gonna, the aides wind up doing an awful lot of work, the good ones anyway, for very little money. Where are we going to get the people we need to do these jobs? And are we going to?
I mean, that's really, I think these are issues of national importance, and I think we're coming up onto a political election, and obviously I haven't written a political book, but I really think politicians should pay attention to what's happening inside of our institutions and look at these issues and look at the payment system and really reevaluate. I mean, I think the fact that our hospitals are looked at as businesses now is not a good thing. I don't think it's helpful. I don't think it improves the quality of care across the board. And I think that we have to really rethink what the role of the hospital and the whole medical field is in our society. Is it really supposed to be, you know, something that's like an investment bank? I think it's a very different kind of profession. And I think that we have to really rethink the whole way people are paid and what's asked of them to make it an area that people want to go into again.
A lot of us are going to be getting very, very sick very, very soon. And there's going to be this great need for medical services. You think we're going to be able to handle that need? Will there be enough hospitals, enough doctors, enough nurses, enough of these aides?
They're only going to be there if we have the political will as a people to say, you know what, the way the system is set up now isn't going to work. Is this really a part of our lives that we want to be controlled by the marketplace? Maybe this is something that it should be looked at as more a public service, the way that we look at public schools or the police department. That I do think, and we also have to think of the training of doctors and nurses. Right now, if you go to medical school or nursing school, you end up with so many bills at the end of your education that's why so many people choose to go into these high-paying specialties, because
that's
if
right.
you come out of... So I think we have to feel, how do we encourage our young people to look at this as a noble profession again? Because I think it is.
Okay, I got to cut you off there. The book is Hospital, Man, Woman, Birth, Death, Infinity, plus Red Tape, Bad Behavior, Money, God, and Diversity on Steroids. The author, our guest this hour, Julie Solomon, will be with us. We're in Columbus tonight, 7 o'clock, signing her book at Barnes & Noble, Lenox Center, Olentangy River Road. Thanks, listeners. Thanks, Julie. That's it for this hour on listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.